morning, everybody. This is Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another episode. This episode is 161, I believe, on the channel. And today, I have the distinct pleasure and honor to have with me Joseph McGuire. Joseph joined me all the way from Ireland, if I get that correctly, from Dublin, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph, welcome to the channel.
Thank you. Thank you, Robin. I'm absolutely delighted to be here. And I don't envy you with all the snow, but we have plenty of rain and wind.
You know, it's winter. Eventually we'll pass and we'll come back to a spring and summer and we'll enjoy both of those seasons. Joseph, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it. I'm looking forward to this conversation. For the audience, Joseph is a facial analysis expert, and he's built a career around this. He's got a practice in this particular field. He is delivering services to his customers on this particular expertise and knowledge. And today I want to get to know Joseph a little bit better and get to know what he does a little bit better. And hopefully in the process, we are educating some of our clients on facial analysis and what it means and what's the benefit of it and how to use it. Joseph, again, welcome to the channel. As we say on this channel, everybody's got a story. So the first question is the easy one, Joseph. What's your story? What got you here?
A long and winded road. Absolutely right. Yes, I am in Dublin. I'm from Dublin, currently living here, but I have lived in other countries. I intend to be living in other countries in the future. And there's what I started out doing, what I intended to be doing for the rest of my life. And then life brought a few, shall we say, speed bumps. So I'm now doing what I'm doing.
Joseph, let's dig into facial analysis. I guess from my perspective, you know, a lot of times there's a lot of data in front of us, and we don't recognize there's a lot of data in front of us, signals, if you want to call them, or however, you know, our audience want to articulate that, indications of sort, be it facial or body language or anything else for that matter. A lot of times, you know, the easy part is to detect signals within words. That's verbal. It's pretty obvious. Everybody would get to know that. But the signals that people don't detect that often, unless you're sitting in the room with an expert, is other types of signals. Can you, if you don't mind, explaining to the audience in layman's term, what is facial analysis and how to use it?
Sure, absolutely. Okay, my background is originally in traditional Chinese medicine, and I was taught the ancient Chinese art of reading faces and body language, which is a 3,000-year-old tradition. The documentation goes back that far. And the understanding is that our static facial features reveal a huge amount of information about personality, character, health, communication styles, and a lot more besides. So that's it in a nutshell. And I've been working with this for some 40 years now, and I've added a lot more to that beyond what I was initially thought.
And so if somebody was to ask you, hey, I'm interested in facial analysis, could you tell me a little bit more about it? How is it used? What do you look for? What does it reveal in some cases or all cases?
Sure. Okay. Well, I started off as a therapist. I was a therapist for 30 years, so I was using it initially in diagnostic terms because that's how I was taught it. But I was actually far more interested in the broader Chinese understanding because it was used in medicine, in business and politics as well. And it was that whole personality side and character communication side that was ultimately far more interesting for me. So when I'm looking at a face, I'm looking at, first and foremost, whether the, as it were, the lights are on. So I'm looking first and foremost at the eyes. And the eyes tell me so much about whether somebody is present, whether they're willing to engage, or whether they're there for their own interests, because we have to be very clear about who we meet and who is advisable to meet and who is not. I'm looking then to see how best to communicate with that person, because their face, particular, the eyes and the eyebrows will tell me a lot about how they best process information, whether somebody's more data oriented, whether somebody's more feeling oriented, whether somebody's more creative. So that will determine the language I use, but also indicate the tone of voice I should use, whether I should speak fast or slow. And then I'm looking at whether somebody is more, in terms of somebody's intellect, whether they're more, they work more systematic, whether they're more very much about structure and systems, whether they're more expansive, more creative thinking. Again, that will influence the language I use. And there's a lot more than I can go into besides that.
Please do. This topic is really fascinating on many angles, specifically for the listeners of this channel. One is on the sales side. It would be very helpful for somebody to be speaking to a customer either via camera or face-to-face and be, let's say, equipped with this type of knowledge to detect and assess and understand what the other party is reacting to. You know, there's a lot of tools out there right now using AI and using various things. There's things called heat mapping, engagement level, measuring all these indicators, but never really heard or practiced, to be honest with you. Although we all know, for instance, when you're talking to somebody, if they're interested or not, I was taught this when I first started selling. If you walk into a boardroom, you're doing your presentation and somebody's yawning, close the presentation, your job is done, it's over. They're not listening to you. In your assessment, can you put that into a salesy perspective? I'm a sales guy. I'm walking to a meeting. I have a boardroom full of people. What is it that I should be paying attention to?
Okay, in terms of static facial features, and I don't just work with static facial features because I do work with body language. I do pay a lot of attention to facial expressions. I do a lot of listening as well. And I do work with sales and I bring all of that into the picture. But the first couple of things, like if you go back a couple of years ago when we were all wearing masks, and it was just the top half of the face was visible. That still reveals so much information to me in terms of how to communicate with somebody. So the first thing is the eyes. If the eyes are big and open, that tells me, as a rule, this is somebody who's more feeling-centered. So I would use language. If I'm looking to sell them something, how does that feel to you? Simple things like that. I would use a very soft tone, very welcoming tone. And my posture would be very open. Because that's part of the big part of the unconscious signals they respond to. Whereas if the eyes are more narrowed, this is somebody who's more typically more analytical. So they're more data oriented. They want the facts. They don't want you to get all happy clappy and, you know, all smiley. That, okay, I'm here for purpose. What's the purpose? And I look at the eyebrows tell me a lot. If the eyebrows are essentially horizontal, and particularly if they're thick, that tells me this is very much somebody who's data oriented. So again, facts, information. And the thicker the eyebrows, the more data they want. Because if they sense that you are holding back important data, like you said, the conversation will close down immediately. Whereas if the eyebrows are horizontal and very thin, they only want bullet points. And if you give them too much information, they're overloaded. One particular client I had a number of years ago was an accountant, and I told her she needed to stop people talking because her eyebrows were very thin. And she said, I tend to let my clients just deluge me with information. So, but when she made that change, I spoke with her a month later, that now I'm getting new business every day because I stop people talking. I tell them what I need. And only need. So very simple things like that. The state, the shape, the position of the eyebrows, the size of the eyes tells you so much about somebody immediately and gives you immediate insight into how best to present to them.
So Joseph, that you and I have been talking like what, 10 minutes now almost? What's your read on me?
Okay. You process information quickly. Your forehead, a sizable forehead, and your forehead curves back nicely. So you process information quickly. You've also got something I haven't touched on here. You've also got these vertical lines here at the beginning of the eyebrow, the early part of the forehead. So you concentrate.
Yeah, these two here.
Yeah. So you've got very powerful concentration. You can be too much of a perfectionist at times, but you like to get into the heart of things, and you really like to understand. But once you're given the information you need, You are not somebody who is going to allow himself to be confined by this is how we do it and this is the only way we're going to do it. You need to be able to expand on it and think, okay, if we took this, we could do that, or we could do this. And you need to be able to bring your creativity into any project you're engaged in, whether it's your own project or working for somebody else, because you have great capacity for imagination. But you have also, going back to the eyebrows, you also have quite thick eyebrows. So you absorb a lot of information before you start taking action.
100%. You know what? You hit the nail on the head. I really appreciate that. And I never had this reading before, but your diagnostics on me is very, very accurate, to be honest with you, because I'm known to take a process and look at it and study it a little bit. But then my objective will be is, can I do it better? Can I break the system? Can I not break it negatively, but break it positively to enhance it, do better with it? I even write my own codes, my own programs, just to get out of the box that I'm in. And, you know, I don't have to wait to anybody. I just learn it and just do it myself.
Yeah, no surprise.
I really appreciate that. So is this skill can be taught? And how long would it take for somebody to learn it? And I'm sure, you know, it's useful. Obviously, I mean, from what you just told me, if you walk into a room, you're able to put all these cards on the table, at least in your mind, as you engage with somebody. It's quite the advantage.
Absolutely. And yes, the skills can be taught. It'll vary depending on how open somebody is and how receptive people are to listening and learning and observing. Because you've probably come across the invisible gorilla, that experiment set up back in 1999, originally by the two psychologists, Chabry and Simons, where they set up the basketball game and they had two control groups. One control group had to count the number of times the team in black tops passed the ball. The other control group had to count the number of times the team in white tops passed the ball. And in the middle of the game, a guy dressed in a gorilla suit walked across the middle of the court, pounded his chest several times and walked off again. At the end, 46% of the total control group had no awareness that anybody in a gorilla suit had been anywhere near the court. And the term inattentional blindness was coined. And most people are not seeing what's actually there. And we tend to think that we see with our eyes. But even though the lens is part of the structure of the eye, in effect, the eye is a lens. And by the time an image reaches the visual cortex back here, it's two-dimensional, it's upside down, and there's approximately a third of the image missing. And the mind fills in the gap based on what it expects to see. So we walk into a room and we see what we expect to see, unless we're really paying attention.
You know what? And this is where presumption comes in and assumptions comes in, right? So you walk into a room thinking that everything's going to be negative. How many times I've done this? I go into a room thinking, oh, I'm going to be chewed alive here. But then I come out positive, happy, and the meeting went well. Everything went positive. I guess I was stressed for nothing.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very, very common experience. And we can also get very caught up in our biases. And that's something I see. That's something I see a lot in the interview process. We register faces in something like 1/17th of a second. And before we've had time to consciously think about anything, we've told ourselves a story about the person whose face we've seen. And we tell ourselves that we create a history for them. And they remind us of somebody we like or somebody we dislike. And that then so often influences how we behave towards them. We expect, going back to the word assumption, we expect to like or dislike them. And that clouds our judgment in terms of the actual potential for the relationship.
So how do you use it how do you use facial analysis in an interview process? Is it a step in the interview process? Process takes many interviews, I'm assuming, and there is one step set called facial analysis, but there's like before and after, or is it part of the entire process?
Yeah, it's part of the entire process. I can get a lot of information from a static facial photo anyway, but typically I will be involved in the interview process itself, and that could be virtual or it could be in person. I do need to meet with the interview panel beforehand, because I do need to assess them, and I also need to prep them in terms of how I operate, because I won't just be there to observe. I will be introduced as a colleague or an associate, so the candidates don't know who I actually am, and I will more than likely speak in the interview, because I'm not just using facial analysis skills. I've also done quite a bit of online training with former FBI and special forces trainers in interrogation, negotiation, elicitation. So I'm bringing those skills into the room with me. So the panel is also told, if I speak, they shut up, because there's a very specific reason for my question. And then when the candidate answers, if I stay silent, the panel stays silent, because there's a reason for my silence. So I'm not just observing the facial features. I'm paying a lot of attention to them, but I'm paying attention to the body language, I'm paying attention to the breath patterns, I'm paying attention to how people speak, changes in tonality, changes in cadence, and then I'm also paying attention to what they're not saying. So it's combining all of those together.
Joseph, if let's say I'm hiring somebody with, and I require that somebody to be with a specific types of skills. Example, I need somebody to be analytical, and I need somebody to be multitasker, and I need somebody not to crumble under pressure. Obviously, we all work in a pressure environment. Is there a way to detect that? Because a lot of people, candidates, are going to come in and say, "I'm your guy. You know, you want multitasker? I am your multitasker. You want somebody to handle pressure? You know, go meet my mother-in-law. You know, that's enough pressure for you." I'm just kidding, by the way. I love my mother. So from your perspective, can you really, you know, take a look at the individual from the facial analysis or the belly behavior, etc., and try to peel out what is truth embedded into our DNA and what is somebody mimicking to become something that this job is asking for?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it wouldn't just be in terms of the face. I have to make that absolutely clear, because otherwise I'd be deluding myself. So we have to ask them questions. One thing I mentioned in terms of the training I've done is elicitation. Elicitation is a very, very powerful way of getting information from people without asking them questions. People typically come into an interview, they're practiced, they've polished off their presentation and all of that. So you have to be able to get behind the image, and you have to be able to get behind what they're saying and how they're saying it. So I'm paying a lot of attention to what's happening with their face when they're speaking. What's happening with their facial expression? If we divide the face itself into two vertical halves, the left side of the person's own face, which is my left side here, the right as you're looking at it, but my left side, that's the private side. The public side is the right side. So I'm paying a lot of attention to what's going on the left side of the face when they're speaking, and whether what's happening, what's happening in terms of what are they expressing on the left side of the face when they claim to be telling the truth, when they're telling me whatever the story is, and then paying attention for what they're not saying, whether they're being vague, whether they're being general, whether they're glossing over something. One of the panel would typically ask them, you know, about aspects of their previous history. I'll be listening for gaps, and then that's where my questioning will come in. But I'll be paying a lot of attention to what's going on the left side of their face as they're speaking. Because so often there's how we present in public and how we present in private are very, very different. Like even in terms of the basic facial structure, we like to think of our faces as being symmetrical, but they're actually not. Apparently 1 in 10 million is. But when I'm paying attention to the left side of the face when somebody's speaking, then I'm getting what's really going on for them. And whether their eye lights up. So there's a lot of subtlety, there's a lot of, if you like, precision in what I'm observing. But that will tell me a lot about whether they're really being true and accurate.
So if I was to ask you, like, what is the benefit of facial analysis? In another word, what problem did you set out to solve? You saw a problem, you solved it. Obviously, it's interesting, very interesting to be able to read somebody's, not just, you know, the facial, the body, the language, what they're missing in their conversation, all that combined together, and get a better and more accurate read on who they are. Are you seeing some benefit of that the whoever hires you, Joseph, for instance, would say, look, I've hired a facial analysis expert or a body language expert like Joseph, for instance, and it benefit me XYZ. What would that be?
Yeah, absolutely. I work in a number of different areas. Over the years, I've worked a lot with teams, and that's to enhance team performance, because so often we have our own default settings. And we so often think because something is clear in my mind, it must be clear in how I'm expressing it and how that other person is receiving it. That's not the case. That's frequently not the case. So I'm helping teams recognize how to communicate with each other. So it's boosting performance levels. It's boosting compatibility within teams. And it's boosting people's confidence within the team, because it enables them to communicate with far greater effect, much more accuracy, greater understanding, and they're a lot happier. So they're more willing to commit within the company to actually be fully present rather than the presenteeism we're seeing in a lot of places. And then where clients are reporting then is greater customer satisfaction, because I'm also helping them read their customers and get the message across.
Now, Joseph, so in your In your opinion, the panels that you've been on, etc., did you see executives and negotiators, fellow interviewers on your panel, did something wrong and they missed the signals? And did you have a chance to train them? Did you tap them on the wrist? How did you solve that? Because I'm assuming you've seen a lot of doozies out there being involved in those types of conversations. And you're not the only one on the panel. Probably there are other people representing other things on the panel. And everybody's got their own style. But here you are watching everybody, not just a candidate. And you're looking at your fellow interviewers and you're thinking, oh my God, don't do that. Don't ask that. What were some of those moments, if you will, and how did you address them immediately or after?
It's often once I've met the panel, I know who everybody is. So there will be a meeting. That's part of the process. That's a vital part of the process. I didn't take that one on board initially. So there were times people made themselves the star of the process. The interviewers, they took it over, and some people had bigger egos, so they just wanted to highlight their experience and their skills, etc., etc. So I had to step up afterwards and accept, okay, I need to be responsible here. And then in some cases, it was very clear I could not work with certain people again because they would not be open to listening. That's just where they were at. But where people were open, I was able to point out that it wasn't serving them and it wasn't serving the company. And that's what I would always highlight. How is this benefiting the company, this behavior, this approach? And the reality is, like, the consistent global failure rate for executive appointments over the last 10 years now, the consistent global failure rate for executive appointments in the first 18 months is somewhere between 40 and 70%. So people are making the same mistakes continuously. So increasingly now, I meet with the panel, I talk with them about where they come from. I'll be assessing them anyway. So I will see where some people are likely to be, shall we say, more invasive of the process, and some people are more likely to be laid back. But I will give them very clear instructions as to my role and what I'm doing. And then there will be a debrief afterwards in terms of what has actually happened, what has been effective, what hasn't. And it took me quite a while probably to step into my own confidence in terms of really taking charge. That, like, this is what's working and this is what's not working for you. And if you continue that process, this is what's going to happen. And there's one other particular thing I have noticed is sometimes I am brought in, but the decision has already been made. I'm brought in for show. I have seen that. And there's one particular example that immediately comes to mind where it was the role of chief auditor in a financial services institution here in Dublin. And it was very clear at a certain point that the internal candidate was going to be successful. And I wrote up a profile anyway. And in my profile, I said he overestimates his own intelligence. Now, I didn't put it quite like that. I put it a bit more diplomatically than that. But I said he overestimates his own intelligence, doesn't pay attention to detail, and has problems delegating. That interview process was in November. Literally on Christmas Eve of that year, one of his team noticed a major issue that the guy had neglected, and they dealt with it. But if they hadn't dealt with it on Christmas Eve, the company would have lost their license to trade at a cost of 20 million euro. And when the CEO was reminded about the profile that I wrote, he said, yeah, I knew all that about the guy, but I thought he would change.
So walking into a situation knowing, it's like the old saying, the problem that you don't know and the problem that you know. I guess knowing it's a bigger problem than not knowing. Not knowing, you can say, well, I didn't know. But knowing and continuing on, it makes it a bigger problem. Do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, there are some... I'm increasingly... Discernment is increasingly one of my values. So there are people where they could make me an offer. We would like you to come on board. But once I meet them, I just know I'm not going to be a fit for them. We're just not compatible. So in some cases, I would just say, no, thank you. And most of my work does come through referral. So it comes through relationships I've established. So people will be informed as to what it is I'm looking for and who I'm not, also the type of person I'm not happy to work with. So there's no point in making those introductions.
Joseph, can your analysis be used or contribute to situations such as negotiating, hiring, and firing? And does it change the outcome in some cases?
Yeah, absolutely. Because again, the range of skills I bring to the table are very handy, very useful, very effective in terms of negotiating. Because again, it never fails to surprise me how many people become really tense and anxious around negotiation. And even people who've been doing it for many years, even very successful business people, can be very anxious around negotiation. And they can get locked down mentally, as it were, locked down in the detail. And they're not reading what's happening across the room, whether that's a physical or a virtual room. And it can very much cloud their judgment. Their anxiety gets in the way of clarity. And they can miss so many opportunities. So I'm helping them prepare. That's the first thing. And I'm doing a trial run. I'm being their counterpart. I'm being a devil's advocate with them. And I'm being as awkward as I can possibly be in a recorded negotiation so that they see how they're likely to come across under pressure. So that's the first thing. That's an education for them. But it also gives me insight into their behavior. Then I will profile their upcoming counterparts. I'll get video or facial photos of their counterparts. So I will get insights into how they're likely to be, the personality, the behavior style, etc. And then I can be in the room in real time. So I'm reading what's happening. And then when there's something going amiss, I'd be recommending, okay, let's take it, you know, let's have coffee here or whatever. I'll have some pre-planned interjection that tells people, okay, we're off track here. So I'm helping them read how people are behaving and what people aren't putting on the table in a negotiation. So absolutely, I can bring a lot to the table.
Now, in a lot of cases when people are trying to hire somebody specifically around this type of position that you're trying to hire for, where skill scarcity is evident and it's there. Example, if you're trying to hire a specific data scientist in a specific field, in a specific geographical area, you don't have too many candidates to pick from. You probably have one candidate and that's it. How much balancing act do you think the company should do between the skills and the credential and the education, et cetera, and the background of the individual that you're trying to hire versus the traits that you're diagnosing for?
Yeah, in a scarcity situation like that, where you're looking for something very, very specific, I'm probably not going to be of huge value. That's down to the company research and how thoroughly they're capable of researching and how thoroughly they're willing to research. And I have come across cases where companies are not, because there is that scarcity, the companies are not willing to really look too much into the character. And if some companies have encountered problems because of that, but I'm not typically really involved so much directly in those kind of scenarios.
Because scarcity dictates it pretty much, right? You don't have many options.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, how does, you know, the traits and the characteristics that you're diagnosing for changes the dynamics when it comes to things like job offers, negotiations, dynamics, if you will? Let's say you got to a short list process with two or three candidates. Do you leverage that from an HR perspective or from a candidate perspective? Do you advise on that?
Yes, typically, I suppose there are a number of aspects to that. I do need to know about the company culture. I don't need to know so much about the technicalities of the role. I do need to know about the company culture. I do need to know about the team that the successful candidate is likely to be working with. I do need to know about the vision for the future, or at least the next 6 to 12 months. What will indicate success and failure? Very basic stuff. That gives me some, I would say, essential preparation in terms of how I approach the interview process and how I can then differentiate between candidates. And then we're going into the sort of process we talked about earlier, where it is, shall we say, nicely interrogating them.
Nicely interrogating them. Now, you know, you mentioned earlier, Joseph, that you've, during COVID, like people were only showing like from here to their eyes, and you were able to read people's cues and facial expressions just from that region in a human face. What do you think of the area where most of these interviews nowadays are happening on Zoom? Because it's globally distributed, it's remote, et cetera. So they don't need to be in your backyard, so to speak. They can be anywhere. How does a virtual interviews differ from physical interviews in your world?
Yeah, it is a different process, because if you're in the same physical location, and you can obviously see a lot more. And ideally, when I'm in a physical interaction with people, I like to see what their feet are doing as well, which might sound a little bit odd in terms, because I'm a facial profiler, but their feet can be very revealing, because when their feet move and how they move can tell me a lot about whether somebody's comfortable or uncomfortable with something that's under discussion right now. And you know the famous interview with Prince Andrew as he was, when his feet started flapping at certain points. So there is a big difference.
That gave him away, right?
Absolutely.
That gave
Absolutely.
Him away, right?
Yeah, yeah. But obviously, we're in the scenario where you can just see the upper chest and the head. So I get a lot of information from that. And even there, I'm paying a lot of attention to somebody's breathing patterns. So the facial features, facial expression, breathing patterns. I'm paying attention to what their shoulders are doing, whether the shoulders are coming up or down or one shoulder. Things like that are very revealing, depending on when they happen. And then it's also the listening bit. And something that's really influenced me over the years is I came across the Chinese expression, the Chinese character rather, for listening, which includes, logically enough, the ears, but it also includes the eyes, it includes the heart, it includes the mind, and it has all of those faculties working together. And that's the reality, because we're never just paying attention with our eyes, we're never just listening with our ears. Our whole body is a transmitter and a receiver. Whether we're in a virtual situation or a physical situation, we're getting what you might call a vibe, a resonance from somebody, and our body is picking up on that. And I pay attention to it. What I typically advise when I'm teaching a class is, yes, pay attention to your gut and then check the evidence. But if your gut is telling you something to be wary, pay attention. And then make sure when you're asking your questions, those questions are precise and calibrated.
Sensory receptors, right? So they're giving you signals. Yeah, absolutely. Now, okay, so I get the idea of face and body language, etc. But it's not mind reading. You know, you're still reading something external. Talk to me a little bit about the error ratio, where you got it, possibly can get it wrong, if there is a possibility for that, etc. So. And how do you compensate?
Yes, we always have to acknowledge the possibility of getting it wrong. And that goes back to that word assumption you used earlier. Any assumption I make, or any possibility of assumption, leads to at least the distinct possibility of making an error. So as far as possible, I've had to learn, and I think I learned it at quite an early stage, to empty myself as much as possible from assumption, presumption. And again, going back to the words I used a few moments ago, always check the evidence. And again, I don't assume that I always get it right, or certainly that I always get it 100% right. But without wishing to sound arrogant, at this stage, it's rare for me to make a significant error.
You know, because you've done it, and it's practice make perfect, right? Is that how it works?
I wouldn't say perfect, but it brings us closer.
Close. It's not like riding a bike. I'm just kidding. No, in the past, I used to use a tool, like there's many tools to diagnose various things, right? So especially in the interviewing process, when, you know, I was working for a large organization, we used to use tools to allow us to do initial filtration. For instance, there was a tool called PI, Profile. It's a personality index or profile index, where, you know, the candidate will ask rudimentary questions, not too many, I want to say about 20. And then it spits out a profile basically on energy, on multitasking, on integrity, a bunch of things, and it graphs it out for you. It's pretty cool. But we always caution people to say, look, the interviewing process is many steps or many items in the interview process. This is just one of them. Don't base your entire reason to make a decision on a specific person based on one single tool in the tool bag. Are you advocating for that as well in your analysis?
Absolutely. It's normal, pretty much any company I work with, that they will use some form of psychometric testing, and psychometric testing has become increasingly sophisticated. In the past, I would have worked a lot with DISC. I would have used Big Five.
Yeah, DISC is famous too, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Where I'm seeing more use of AI informs in terms of the psychometrics. And it's, like I say, it's becoming much more sophisticated. But and I can work alongside that, absolutely, because AI is not going to pick up at this stage anyway. It's not going to pick up a lot of those little the emotional elements that I will spot, which can be so revealing.
Absolutely. Now, what happened in the case, you know, there's cultural biases or biases of any sort, not necessarily just cultural. Do you compensate for that, or does it get into your equation of how you read things? Because I'm assuming it differs from one culture to another.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's something I've been learning a lot about. I grew up in Ireland when it was a very monocultural society. So when I left Ireland, I went abroad, and that was such a wonderful exposure. And most of my intimate and relationships and close friendships now are people from very different countries, very different cultures. So I'm continually learning about cultural nuance. And so if I'm meeting people on the panel from different cultures, I'll be paying attention. I may be asking them questions just to further my own education, but I will also be then looking at the cultural background of the candidates, because again, how they speak, how they present can be so different to, if you like, our standard presentation in the West. Even things like very basic things, like somebody in India or Pakistan will often, you know, bob their head like that. And it doesn't tell you anything, just that's all they're doing. It's not a yes or a no, it's just what they do.
Yeah.
And some, you know, there are cultures where nodding like this means no. We would take it as a yes. So we have to be informed about the cultural differences. It's essential in today's world.
Can AI help?
Yeah, absolutely. Why not? Yeah.
I mean, I was just thinking more like in pattern detections, you know, and various other cues. I'm assuming if I can take a video, recorded video of an interview and give certain cues for AI, it will do some of the pattern detections, etc. I'm assuming, like anything else with AI, 100% not accurate, but it's, have you experimented with that?
I haven't directly, but I know there's one of my connections in Scotland. I can't remember whether he's in Glasgow or Edinburgh. He's very much in that space, particularly the recruitment side more than the interview. But in terms of clarifying who are the best candidates, that's very much the space he's in. And I see absolutely no reason why AI is going to go there anyway. And there's no reason why it can't be used very, very effectively.
And, you know, I mean, again, we were just talking about it earlier in an earlier podcast I recorded this morning. We're still in a trust phase, and a lot of people will get over it soon, I'm hoping. But we're still trying to figure out, where does AI fit in every profession, in every walks of life? You can't apply it everywhere blindly. You have to pick your battles, I guess, with AI. Anything else. It's not a magic wand, for sure.
No, and we have to make sure that the people who are programming the AI are not putting their biases in. That's been one of the
failures. Yeah, ethical AI is a big topic right now. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, security, data governance, where's the data going? What's it? You know, you got to get into privacy when you're talking about candidates and candidates' information too. So you don't want that information to be on the black web somewhere. You want to contain it, secure it, and protect it. If you had to give leaders one rule about reading people, what would that be?
Listen more than you speak. That's the first thing. Really, really fine tune your listening skills. That might sound a little bit odd coming from a facial profiler, but I'm paying a lot more attention to listening than I've ever done before. Because so many people coming for in executive roles or coming for executive appointments or even in high stakes negotiation, very polished, very articulate, very smooth, can use speech very, very well, how they speak. And it's so essential to be able to look behind for what's going on behind the words. Because the way I describe it, words are like the frosting on a cake, but they're not the cake.
That's right. Now, I see a lot of application for this. I see, like I mentioned, sales, but could be anything really. Any customer facing, any internal facing. If you're interacting with any human at any level, you're not just sitting in a bubble somewhere. You probably need to get that skill. How do you people can get started with this? How do they learn it?
Typically, most of what I've been doing in recent times has been in-house for companies or for organizations. I've done shorter courses of my own, but That's just more from my own experience and more just playing around with ideas than anything else. If anybody's looking to inquire or to hire me, the best way to reach out to me is to find me on LinkedIn, and then we arrange a call to discuss what's happening.
Yeah, and for the audience and for the listeners, if this topic is of interest to you and you need to get a hold of Joseph McGuire, he's connected to me on LinkedIn. I'll be happy to make an introduction. So if you can't find Joseph, I'm sure you can find me, and I will be happy to facilitate an introduction. So reference this podcast, and I'll be putting you in touch with Joseph to take it from there. Joseph, as we come close to the end of our podcast, any final thoughts? Anything else that I should talk about, but I have missed to talk about, that we probably should address before we finish off?
Well, we're in a changing world, Robin. We're in the world which is rapidly, rapidly changing. But there's still the issues of trust, respect, autonomy, and communication. They're being reported time and time again. You look at McKinsey, you look at Forbes, you look at Gallup, you look at Edelman. Those issues are coming up time and time and time again in the workplace. And the willingness of leaders to communicate is in question. And the willingness of leaders to communicate with clarity is so, so important for not just for now, but for the work, for companies to thrive going forward. So no matter how AI develops or any other advances in technology, it still comes down to people. And even with AI taking over and a lot of jobs maybe disappearing, we're still going to need people.
Absolutely correct. Joseph, I want to thank you for joining me today. I really appreciate it. That was fascinating.
Thank you so much, Robin. Absolute pleasure as always speaking with you.
Absolutely. And for the audience, thank you so much for listening in. I really appreciate it. If you're coming on YouTube, thanks for watching us. If you're coming on the podcast streaming platforms, thanks for downloading our podcast. We're averaging about 1,500 downloads per day now. And thanks to you for this, our listeners. And thanks for the 49 countries where you guys are listening in from. And thanks for the 2.5 million views we've accumulated the past the 7 days past. Thanks so much for making us part of your journey. And also thank you, which I probably mentioned it before, but thank you for making us top 5 podcast in the world in the conversational category. Thank you so much for this. I really appreciate it. And I'll see you at the next episode. Stay around.